Thanks a lot, Anna. Here I get to try the microphone out again. Hello, testing, testing. Is the mic on? Okay. Wait, what?
It's a trying
situation. Yeah. Would someone try? What?
I believe it's a paradigm.
It's a paradigm. Okay. What happened last week? Somebody threw their keys up at the. Hello, people. Hello. Hello, can anyone hear? Is that better? Okay, good. All right, well, I try to get used to the MIT paradigms. So today's talk, I'm talking today about randomization and religion. And actually at the end, before the questions, I'll remind you what the other talks are. I've got six talks altogether, five more after last week. And these five are pretty much independent of each other. If you miss 2, 3, and 4, that doesn't make you ineligible to come to number 5. And if you don't like any of them, you can stop coming altogether or whatever. But each talk is pretty much independent. And I have lots of things I wanted to say during these lectures, and I tried to partition them into segments, and things that I thought I would say in one I turn out to fit better in another, and so on. So that way I can try to balance the thing. Today I thought I would talk about randomization, because it really, in my sub area of computer science, one of the most important breakthroughs. If somebody would ask me what in the last 10 years. What was the most important change in the study of algorithms? I would have to say that people getting really familiar with randomized algorithms had to be the winner. Already in the 1940s, people invented the Monte Carlo method, which was used a lot in, you know, for calculations with nuclear physics and so on. In the 50s, people invented hashing. In the 60s, we played around with randomizing of data. In the 70s, we applied randomization to factoring and things. But then all of a sudden, it got a big boost by quite a few other discoveries. For example, network routing and things like that in the 80s. And now it's to the point where there's lots of universities have a course that runs either half year or full year on randomized algorithms. Textbooks have come out, there's proofs now that for some problems, randomization allows us to solve them faster than any method that didn't use random numbers. Any deterministic method has to run a lot slower than a method that takes advantage of randomization. Yesterday I was at Harvard, and I spoke to Michael Rabin, who I think everyone considers to be the father of randomized algorithms. And to my great surprise, here he is in the audience today. I asked him if he would have some advice on what I should talk about today, randomization and religion. And his first reaction was that I should talk about the question: Do random numbers really exist? Because this gets into question of free will and the questions of what is the world deterministic and so on. That's one of the questions I'm not going to discuss today. That's for lecture number 6. The lecture number 6 I do plan to discuss as far as I can things about free will and omnipotence of God and things like this, and I hope I'll have something interesting to say at that time. But today I'm talking about a different aspect of the subject. And from my personal point of view with randomized algorithms, about 1970, I published a paper that explained a method I'd been using a lot during the 60s to estimate the running time of backtrack programs. Backtrack programs, the computer scientists in here, one of the standard things that people teach in programming classes is the N queens problem. How do you put 20 queens on a 20 by 20 chessboard in all possible ways, or maybe 10 or 8 on an 8 by 8 chessboard and so on. Probably the only decent way until N gets real large to solve this problem is by process of trial and error, where you first try placing one queen, and you try placing the second, and so on. When you have a backtrack algorithm like this, experience shows that sometimes the backtrack process runs zip in a second or two. Sometimes you look at it and it looks like it's going to take many, many centuries before it stops. And it's not easy to tell the difference. So I worked out a method by which, by rolling the dice, I could take a random path. First I place a, it's an extremely simple method. For the N queens, I would first say put the first queen in a random place and write down the number of possibilities I had. Then I put the second queen in a random place consistent with that and write down how many choices I had for that and keep on going. And I multiply all those numbers together and add them in a certain way, and you can prove that the expected value of this quantity is the expected number of computations you're going to need in order to solve the problem. So I published that, as I say, about 1970, and I had some experience. It worked amazingly well, actually. In 1976, I gave a talk here in Boston at the survey talk about it was called Coping with Finiteness at the meeting of the American Association for Advancement of Science. And in that talk, I used this estimation method for this problem. I say, how many ways are there to get from one corner of this grid to the opposite corner by a path that doesn't cross itself? So some path like this. This is an 11 by 11 grid. And by taking a random walk on this thing, and sometimes I have two choices, sometimes I have three for the next step, multiply it together, and so on. On a computer, I tried this a few thousand times, and I estimated in that talk that the total number of paths from corner to corner would be 1.6 plus or minus 0.3 times 10 to the 24th. Now, but I didn't believe that ever in my lifetime I would know the answer to that problem. I just, a huge number like that, no matter how computers are getting faster and faster, but this is way, way out there, 10 to the 24th, it's we're going to be through a lot of more Y2K crises before that would happen. So, the Y10 crisis, if you think Y2K is bad, wait until the year 9999. A couple of years later, Richard Chappell, who was an illustrious MIT grad, pointed out that there was, in fact, a way to calculate this number exactly. And nowadays, we would say it's because the problem has small tree width. And in fact, on a PC, we could do it now in about 10 seconds. And here's the exact number. Now, to my great relief, it was, in fact, 1.6 times 10 to 20. I don't know. Maybe I was just lucky. But anyway, this was the way I got started in randomization. Okay. So for quantitative problems, it was clearly a win. But I started using it also for qualitative things. As a teacher, for example, in teaching at Stanford, I often use randomization when I'm grading papers. I'm sure students sort of suspected this all the time, but in fact, let me explain. So a student presents me with a 200-page listing of a program that they wrote. This is a term project, and I don't have time to read that 200-page listing. So I turn to a random page, and I look very closely at what's on that page, and that suggests other pages that I should look at. And so I look, the part that I do look at, I check over very carefully, and that, that'll call a subroutine. Maybe I have to check out what that subroutine does and go through the program. But I don't have to read all 200 pages. Student doesn't know which page I'm going to look at. And so I could get a pretty good idea as to the quality of the program by this approach. And in fact, now there's all kinds of theories about zero knowledge proofs and things where people can prove that they know something without revealing how they do it and so on. There's randomization has turned out to be useful also in ways we didn't suspect at all. A few years later, I tried to figure out what is mathematics, in other words, I wanted to know what I would have to teach a computer in order to say the computer understood mathematics. And the way I approached this was I took nine books that I felt were typical of things mathematicians do, and I looked at page 100 of each book. And I said, now how would I have to program a computer so that it would be able to create or at least understand the mathematics that's on page 100 of these nine books? And I think by this means, I'm not calculating some formula where I get plus or minus in something like this, but it gave me much better insight into this question as to what is mathematics than if I had just asked a bunch of mathematicians what it was, or if I looked at somebody else's definition. Now, shortly after that, then I decided to do a similar thing with the Bible. It was 1978. I think last week I said 76. I was mistaken. I looked at my diary again today. But anyway, so the Bible. I wanted to study verses of the Bible, and there are about 31,000 verses in the Bible altogether. So one way you could study this, by similar to the way I did with the student grading and asking what is mathematics, I could take these 31,000 verses and put them onto slips of paper and put this into a big urn. And then I could stir the urn, and then draw out random slips of paper. And I would look at what was on those slips of paper, and that would give me some idea as to what's in the Bible. It's even better, however, my experience with these backtrack calculations showed it would even be better. It would be better than that if I would make sure that I would choose. Let's suppose I was choosing 60 verses, for example. It's better if I choose one verse out of each book of the Bible. The Bible actually has 66 books. So in this way, it's called stratified sampling to statisticians. I'm sure that things aren't all lumping into the same place. I thought, well, it'd be neat to try this and just to see what I get. So I was asked at that time to teach a Bible class at my church. For years I had always been sitting in, but never as the teacher. And they said, hey, Don, it's your turn now. So I said, okay. So if you're right, you can go through with me this experiment. We're going to look at random verses of the Bible. And so the assignment for the first day of class, everyone was supposed. I decided a way that I could get one verse out of each book of the Bible was to look at chapter 3, verse 16. I'll explain a little more about that in a minute. But basically. For the first class, everyone was asked to look at Genesis 3:16, Exodus 3:16, Leviticus 3:16, the first three books of the Bible, in chapter 3, verse 16, in preparation for the. And I hadn't read those verses yet myself. It's important that if you're doing an experiment like this, you don't rig the data. So. However, I did rig, of course, in one place. A lot of you will know that the most famous verse in the Bible, in the whole Bible by its number, is John chapter 3, verse 16. The reason I rigged it in this way, in fact, was because I didn't want the pastor of my church to say this class was a dud and we didn't get to anything interesting. So we were sure at least to hit one good one in the class. Now, this, not, you know, John 3:16 is so famous, you know, even in Singapore, later on when I wrote this book called 3:16, the title of the book, if you can see it, it just says 3:16. The book was printed in Singapore, and all the correspondence with Singapore says, you know, with the printers in Singapore says that we're sending you this book, and you know, all the plates for printing this book called 3:16. But when the boxes came back and were shipped to America, it was all identified as John 3:16. So even in Singapore, where less than 10% of the people are Christian, somehow they knew that John 3:16. I mean, maybe they're watching football programs or something. So a lot of people think that the title of this book is John 3:16 because that verse is so famous. It was for me it was a catchy number that the people in my class would know, so they'd be able to remember what it was. You know, they wouldn't have to look it up. So now we could have rolled dice. You know, we get a better random sample. We get a better random sample if we use randomization instead of a fixed deterministic method like chapter 3, verse 16. There's no reason for us to think that there's anything unusual about the chapter 3, verse 16, except in the book of John. But I didn't like this idea of rolling dice for several reasons. One is that we would have to do it in advance, or if people were going to prepare for the class. And then, if you miss a class, then you don't know what to do for next time. But the other one is that when you roll a dice, there's a temptation to cheat and to say that, you know, you get a bad roll and you say, well, I didn't really, you know, it slipped. There was something on the table that bumped into it. Let's try again, you know. And so this way, it was a rule that actually couldn't be rigged. I'll give you some other examples. If I were an astronomer, I would love to make a look at random points in the sky. I would choose, I would like to make a really exhaustive survey of different parts of the sky, random sky, but I would try to choose them in some way that it wouldn't, you know, it's not some other astronomer telling me what place to aim my telescope, but I would just find, and I would announce in advance, before I had looked anywhere, I would announce in advance how I was going to do this by some rule that couldn't be rigged. For example, I'd base it on the digits of pi. Somehow, you know, you'd use digits of pi, say 1,000 through 1,005 or something like this, to get the coordinates. This would be pi in the sky. I really believe that a survey like that would be quite informative. Okay. Now, another example was told to me by my son-in-law on Sunday. He said he was inspired by this 3:16 book to start up the H20 project, which would give them ideas. What is Massachusetts? They have a book of maps of Massachusetts that are at a large scale, and they live. You know, Greg is in civil engineering here at MIT, and they live pretty near the campus. And they live in H20 in the corresponding map of Cambridge, and so they're going to try to visit H20. In all the other parts of this map, and that'll give you a pretty good idea as to what Massachusetts is like, really. Okay, the election is Cambridge is having an election for a city council coming up next month, and I would think that, you know, if I were mayor of Cambridge, I would do the following. Cambridge has about 100,000 people in it, and I would divide the city into 50 sections, say. And about equal size or population, I guess. And then I would find some way to select one person at random in each of those 50 districts, and I would set aside maybe Wednesday evening, afternoon, where I would invite that person over to my house and get to know them very well. And after a year, I would have gotten the idea as to what 50 people of Cambridge want the mayor to do and how I could help them best. I think this is this would be way better than just, you know, listening to people who paid most for your campaign. Right, and in fact, so I'm doing the same kind of thing you see with the Bible, as you'll see in a minute. I try to really interview the verses that I've chosen. When I'm in a bookstore nowadays, or in a conference where I'm looking at a table full of new books, I try to gauge how good the book is that I'm looking that's there by. Well, I guess I have to reveal the secret. So I turn to page 316. And I sort of make an impression of the whole book by reading that page as carefully as I can. If a book is short, I use page 100. So if you know, authors take note, you know, if you want me to. It works quite well, I think. I don't want to go on it, but you know, it's something like the Gallup poll, where the people in the Gallup poll go out and interview 1,000 people, and then they tell us what Americans are thinking. This sampling method really gives, although it's not guaranteed to work at all, it really has an amazing power to give you a lot of insight in making fairly good use of your time. Give you a lot of insight about any complicated subject. So anyway, that's why I tried the 316 rule in 1978, and I had to debug the rule. After the class got going, I soon realized that some books of the Bible don't have three chapters. So in fact, there are seven books I had to leave out because we didn't get up to 316 out of the the 66 books. We're down to 59. In fact, there was a close one. The book of Titus ends at chapter 3, verse 15. We went a little further and realized that had to go back to the drawing board again, because sometimes there's a chapter 3, all right, but it doesn't have 16 verses, so we had to go into chapter 4. So the idea was that the rule was really the 16th verse after the beginning of chapter 3. Provided that you can get that far. Okay, now, so anyway, this gave us 59 pretty random verses of the Bible, except in the case of Book of John, and this poster shows the 59 verses, plus the logo 316 to make it 6x10. I had this poster in my office for 10 years now, and it's kind of interesting. I don't get tired of it. I look up at it again, and I see something new, partly because the artwork is good, but also I like it because it's kind of a map of the Bible, the map of the themes of the Bible. And in fact, some people have called this method of Bible study the way of the cross section. I'm sorry. the Bible class was remarkably successful, and started out with about a dozen people the first week, and we went on for about half a year, and the interest continually was building. We had to move to another room, a larger room, and so on. And so, you know, last week I promised to explain this idea about chapter 3, verse 16, why it would make perfect sense, and I hope now you understand. Let me think. Why did it seem to work out? I think there are two main reasons why it proved to be good. The first reason you can understand if you think of the traditional definition of a liberal education. I've heard this. I don't know where I heard it first, but it was a liberal education is supposed to teach you something about everything and everything about something. And here was a good case in point. That is, I knew something about all parts of the Bible because I had been going to church and Lutheran schools and so on in my early years. But I didn't know. There was no part of it where I had ever tried exhaustively to find everything out. And it means a great deal whether you, when you have some, where you have just a vague knowledge about everything, or if there are a few things that you really know, where you really feel you've surrounded them, and you found out just about everything about them that you could. This is similar to what a lot of colleges try to teach. So, as I'll try to explain, with these 59 verses, I tried to find out, not just look at them casually and say, oh, ah, great. But instead, I go to the library and I would try to scour the best libraries of the world to find out what everybody that has written about these verses has said about them as much as I can. Fortunately, with the Bible, it's possible to do this because books about the Bible are very often indexed by the verses of the Bible that they refer to. So I could just look in the index at the back of the book, and that told me what pages to look at of large books. I could go through shelf after shelf and pretty soon scour things. Commentaries are organized by verses. So it's lots of resources available in the library where I could, in fact, do a fairly quick getting up to speed on any one particular verse of the Bible. This would take, it's no good if you're going to try to learn all 31,000 verses and everything about all those. But for a few of them, especially in these cases where the verses weren't really famous, it was pretty easy for me to be, I could become the world authority on Leviticus 3:16 because nobody else would have done all this homework about that particular thing. In fact, by this means, even though I had only 59 verses and I'm looking at only 1/500th of the Bible, it was amazing that the different subjects that came up in this sent me through to the rest of the Bible. And I have to talk more about that later. But the really big win for this method is not for studying the Bible itself. I mean, Bible isn't that long a book. You can read it all the way through. My great grandfather was a blacksmith, and I learned that he had a copy of the Bible in German and he read it several times through during his life. I don't think he was an educated man, but certainly it's possible to do that. But the thing that nobody can do is read all the secondary literature about the Bible. There's tens and thousands of books, maybe hundreds of thousands of books, and it's so daunting that certainly somebody like me who's not a theologian would never crack open any of those books because there's too many of them. Or else the only ones I would crack open are biased to the ones that people tell me to read. But as a scientist, I don't feel that comfortable with just reading the top 10 or something that somebody says is popular or great. I want to know something about the ordinary parts of the Bible in order to really assess what the Bible is about. When I first did the class, I didn't really do it exhaustively. I went to Stanford Library on Saturday, and I would spend a few hours preparing to reading up on five commentaries or something and a few translations of the verses that we were going to do on the next day, Sunday. But later on, after this class worked out so well, and I decided that really this method was so sufficiently interesting that I ought to make a book about it. Then I really took it seriously, and I would work on each verse probably 3 days solid. I would start Friday afternoon, and work intensively through until Monday noon on each one, and by really going to the best libraries I could find the best resources and checking out. Everything there, so I could read books that went on through many centuries by authors with many different viewpoints. Of course, I read the classical commentaries by the most famous rabbis. I read things like the mystical literature from Saint Bernard of Clairvaux. I read Thomas Aquinas and Scholastics. I read Calvin's commentaries. You know, as a Lutheran, I wouldn't be ordinarily motivated to look at John Calvin's writings because I've heard about him. You know, they're dangerous. But in fact, he wrote commentary on every book of the Bible, and so I only had to read 59 pages of those commentaries, basically, and I found that they were great. I mean, I really thought he had insights that I didn't find in any of the others, and so on. I read many dozens of commentaries by Catholic, Protestant, Jewish theologians. In the 20th century, from ultra-conservative to ultra-liberal, and this way I could kind of surround these 59 verses. I got to know them pretty well. In fact, I think of these 59 verses as like pegs on which I can hang a knowledge of the Bible. Every time I hear something about the Bible since then, it reminds me of something that's close to one of the 3:16. So I now have these sort of solid things that before I didn't have anything solid. I just had a lot of wishy-washy approximation. But here I have some solid things on which I can attach other stuff. So that's why I say this method turned out to be a success. On the other hand, sampling can be ineffective or misleading if you don't understand the limitations of the method. In fact, I have to also say that when I'm working on this book, sometimes I'd wake up and wonder if the whole thing was, you know, if I wasn't just being totally insane by studying studying things this way. Then I remind myself, well, maybe no, it's okay. In the first place, there's an obvious danger of confusing my approach with numerology. In fact, it surprised me, but a lot of people, when they first heard that I was studying the 3:16, they figured out, well, I must believe there's something magical about these verses. You know, the number 3 and 16, 16 is a perfect square. Wow, you know, and 3.16 is a square root of 10. So then people would send me letters trying to get me out of this delusion. They would say, Don, don't you realize that the chapter and verse numbers were added to the Bible long after the material was written? And that was precisely my point. The point was that it couldn't mean anything that it was chapter 3, verse 16. What I was looking for was precisely something that is a plain, old, ordinary, non-special verse that is neither known to be exceptional in any direction, except in the case of the book of John, where, in fact, when I studied the book of John, I didn't have any, you know, to get my satisfaction, I studied John 16:3. But I had to put 3:16 in this book because people were looking for it. But for myself, I got more out of a random verse. Well, history is full of misguided attempts to read the Bible as a book of mathematics because it's so easy to find patterns in numerical data. I think a lot of you know that Hebrew and Greek letters were associated with ways of representing numbers. So every word could also be have a numerical significance. And so a lot of people study what's called gematria, where you try to find some great significance in the numbers that are represented by words in the Bible. The most famous in recent years of this kind is the book called The Bible Code, which was a bestseller 2 years ago. Here's the Bible Code started. Well, there were several really excellent mathematicians in Jerusalem who noticed some numerical things about the Hebrew letters in the Bible that they couldn't understand. Why they should have this pattern, and another man heard about it and decided to write this book called The Bible Code, in which he has the Bible prophesying things that are going to happen in the future. And so I looked it up on the web today, and I found that there was some really neat developments to this, because not only has this have these patterns been explained by statisticians, but also a guy from CNET found prophecies foretold in the Microsoft Access Developers Toolkit 2.0 license agreement. And on Yahoo Internet Life, you could, you know, they have encrypted references to Bill Gates in the Book of Revelation, and several websites started, or were started by people where you could look up and make your own predictions, you know, and so, but really this what? So, yeah. Exactly. So. So anyway, this page, so then I looked at Amazon.com to find out if the book is still selling well now 2 years later, and so it's ranked 3967 among all Amazon.com's books. That's that ranks somewhere between volume 1 and volume 3 of The Art of Computer Programming. it's way ahead of this book. This book is 54,000 today. Now, okay. So anyway, has 207 customer comments. They're quite fascinating. Everybody gives it either 1 star or 5 stars. Numerology is fun sometimes, but actually sometimes people can get some satisfaction out of it if they don't misunderstand it. In fact, it reminded me of a few other things. In the early 80s, I was writing the tech book, the user manual for tech, and I was looking for quotations to put at the end of the chapters of that book. And I forget exactly why, but I was led through some different quote books and sources. I was led to John Wesley's collected works, and I found the following in volume 5 of his collected works. At some rare times, when I've been in great distress of soul or in other uncertainty how to act in an important case that requires speedy determination, after using all other means that occurred to me, I've cast lots or opened the Bible, and by this means I've been relieved from that distress or directed in that uncertainty. The amazing thing is that this occurs on page 316. You can look it up. He's using randomization for a different purpose. He's using it for divine guidance. There are cases in the Bible where people cast lots, and which means in those days rolling bones to find out how the bones would land, and. I know in China they use the I Ching with randomization. When I was in Japan at Shinto temples, they had a really neat randomizing device. I don't know what it's called, where you shake it and out comes a stick, and the stick has some kind of marks on it, tells you which box to go for your fortune for the day or something like this. There's a tradition of trying to maybe God is forcing the way the dice are rolling or something that will send some message. People have this craving to find out. However, I don't know that there might be something to that, but I'm not doing it that way at all. My use of random numbers is not because of any magic there. I'm just trying to be systematic about the whole thing. Now, but I have to tell you another story that I decided not to put in the book because I didn't want to mislead people. Six days before I was starting to teach this class, I announced the class and said, come on Sunday reading Genesis 3:16 and so on. I found myself in Stanford Hospital needing emergency surgery. It wasn't serious, but after I woke up and I was feeling kind of rotten, I wondered whether I should maybe postpone the Bible class. But then I noticed a curious thing. My hospital room number was 316. So maybe God was smiling on this project, you know. I got another story for you. Lloyd Wehner was a famous baseball player for the Pittsburgh Pirates. He was born on March 16th in 1906. Now that's the 16th day of the third month, 3/16/06. And his lifetime batting average was 316. Could that be purely coincidental? And the answer is yes, absolutely. I mean, I started with, you know, I got this book of statistics, and I knew I would find something about 316 in there, you know, in order to make this example. So when you have a number in mind, you'll find that number a lot, and other numbers will go out of your consciousness, and so you only remember this. And Richard Feynman told this interesting story about the time when he's in Los Alamos and his wife is in the hospital. She was an invalid and in a city a couple hours away, I think. And he woke up suddenly one morning with a premonition that she really needed him. And he drove to this other city. Well, no, nothing at all. It was just a random day for her. So he says, I report this because people always report the times when these premonitions succeed, but they never report the times when they fail. Okay. So you have to understand coincidences in this way, I think. Now, but the main danger to avoid when you're using an approach like I did for the sampling is to just look is to close your eyes to everything except the verse that you've selected. Like if I pick these things out of the urn and I would just look at that verse, and then I would think about it. Maybe I would meditate about it, but I would just think about that one, and block out the context of the thing. Well, in the first place, I had to have to think, what if people were to pore over the sentences of my own books in this way? I mean, the author, what if somebody were to take a word on page 316 of my book, you know, and hang on, or a sentence, and hang on every word of that sentence, you know, maybe write PhD thesis about what did I have in mind as I'm doing it? People examine the Bible with such an intense magnifying glass. You can't help but think the authors didn't really intend it for that to be scrutinized to this thing, because they were thinking of a flow of many verses. Of course, I can't understand what's in the 316 verse just from the 316 verse itself. I try to put a very intense light on that verse. In other words, I try to study all the problems that might have occurred in transmission, but by copying, you know, the Bible is thousands of years old, and over the years, the manuscripts got copied. They didn't have digital storage, and errors would creep in, so you have to look at many different manuscripts, and it was amazing to me. In fact, I didn't realize how almost every verse of the Bible has cases where the scholars who collate these manuscripts have had to make a call on what was the original. In the 316 verse, I will look at all of these cases and I'll check over what the scholars have, you know, what the different manuscripts said, and to get some idea as to how much variation there is. But then I also look at the, you know, 315 and 317, the neighboring verses. But the light isn't so strong on those verses. I'm not going to study all the details of those verses. I'll accept the majority of opinion about what's the proper text of those verses, and the 14 and 18 even less. And so in this way, just as when I was grading the student papers, I would take the page I chose would lead me to a few other pages, but the farther away I get from my selected page, the less time I put into actually doing it. But the idea is to do this interpretation is to try to let the Bible interpret itself. When I'm trying to understand it, and I find another verse that has the same vocabulary, I look at that verse. Find another verse that treats the same topic, I look at that verse. And that leads me through a lot more than the 59 verses of the Bible. In fact, my book also has an index of the Bible verses that are cited in the book, and the index goes over many, many pages. And for example, in Isaiah, it's 120, 126, 22, 23, 24, 27, 28, 34, 314, and so on. All these, of course, chapter 3 you'd expect, but anyway, all the way through the all the way through the Bible, I'm checking out many other parts of the Bible in order to understand the 3:16s. Not to such a great concentration, but as part of showing light on it. Also, the number of topics that this lead that these verses led to was amazingly diverse. I try to prove it to you by somebody would call out a random letter of the alphabet, and I can read you some entries out of the index of the book. P, D, D for Don. Okay, so here we go. Daniel, Dante, David, Day of Jehovah, Dead Sea Scrolls, Death, Delitzsch, Depression, Deutero-Isaiah, Deuteronomic History, Dice, Disarmament, Disciples, Divorce, Domination, Doubts, Dove. Okay, and these are topics and people that occur in the discussion of the 3:16. So in this way, by taking the context too, you're not making the mistake. In fact, I found out after publishing this book that other people had independently come up with this with the idea. I mean, pastors in New Hampshire and Missouri both wrote to me that they had. Thought of doing this and preached some sermons about the 3:16s, and a man in Pennsylvania had used them for study, and he sent me a copy of his notes on them. But in that case, I didn't care for what he sent me, because he was only looking at the 3:16 verse, and he would quote the verse, and then he would make some kind of to my mind rather simplistic summary of the thing again, and then go on to the next one. I find the really important thing is that you go into it strong, so that you get this feeling of getting as much as you can out of the parts that you do choose to study. Now, does this rule of the 3:16s give a decent sample? I know in a lot of computer programming, I don't have to have a truly random number, but if I have some other way of doing it, it turned out to be random enough for practical purposes. But there's little problems, because the chapter 3 is near the beginning of a book, and so it tends to be the book has started to get underway, but it tends to be something that happens in the early part of a story. So in fact, we have in chapter 3 we find the call of Moses, the call of Samuel, the call of Ezekiel, and the call of Jesus. In the Gospels, we're always talking about something that occurred early in Jesus' ministry. So that's not quite as varied as you would get from a random thing. More, but that didn't really seem to matter too much. The more serious might be that some books are oversampled and some are undersampled. If you have the Psalms, for example, there are 150 Psalms, but I only get to look at one. The book of Isaiah has a big break at chapter 40, where it seems that there's quite a different author at the end. I'm not seeing the other parts. On the other hand, in the Hebrew Bible, the book of Prophets, which in our English Bible we call we separate out into the minor prophets. So we have Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, all as separate books, while in the Hebrew Bible it's one book. So the sampling works out that I learn a lot more about minor prophets than I do about Isaiah in this way. It's something like in the U.S. Senate, the Rhode Island has the same number of senators as Massachusetts does, but it's not, because every state is equal. Nevada and California are equal. So there's a little error in the sampling for that. But all told, I would say, after avoiding those pitfalls, I think this methodology worked quite well, except for one thing, and that is I was overconfident after I did it. It worked too well. I felt that I had learned much more than I really I mean, I have to keep telling myself I've only looked at 1/500th of the Bible, because the fact that I have surrounded a few verses gave me this feeling that I knew everything for some reason. I mean, you have to resist this temptation to think that that really I wouldn't have found out a lot more by studying more. Because the methodology gives you this chance to sort of feel to feel that you've learned something solid. I've run a little past what I thought I would, but there's still plenty of time for questions, more than half hour. As Anna said, it would be best if we tried to keep today's questions to things about randomization. I'll give you a preview of what the next lectures are going to be. Next week, Anna's out of town, so we're waiting for 2 weeks. 2 weeks from today, I'm going to talk about translating the Bible into English. And the idea being that even without knowing Hebrew and Greek, you can learn a lot by trying to translate yourself using some good reference books. The week after that I'm talking about aesthetics. I want to explain about things that the artwork that came in for this book taught me, and I'll talk and a few other things about the way that beauty can contribute a lot to logic and to intellectual things, some things that come through with our other senses and with somehow these aspects of aesthetics that we don't know how to define. The week after that is a panel discussion. And there we'll have some very distinguished speakers. We're going to announce who they are later on. In the fourth lecture with the artwork, I'm going to bring. That's going to be a lot of great pictures. I'm going to show you a lot of things that some artists sent me. There was more than I could put in the book, and I'd like to show you a lot of great artwork at that time. Then the fifth lecture, I'm going to summarize what I learned about the Bible by this 316 method and what I learned about Bible scholars by this 316 method, as far as, you know, at least what I think I learned because of all this all this surveying. You know, you can so that's, you know, the conclusions. Today I'm talking about the methodology. Fifth lecture I'm talking about what I think the methodology gave me as output. And the sixth lecture is where I'm trying to do to explain computer science approaches to some of the really tough questions of theology, things like free will, as I said before, and determinism, things like the evolution and creation, I have a whole bunch of other ideas I'm saving for that sixth lecture, just because I didn't want to have it anticlimax. So that's coming up in the future. But now that's all I had to say about randomization today, except for your questions. Yes, you have a question. Yeah.
But have you started to expand outwards? Did you have any means of sort of making it somewhat objective as to what subsidiary verses you look at?
Right. Okay. So the question is, after, you know, I start with 316, but then I can, but then it's up to me to decide what interests me for the other. So I was systematic in the sense of that I'll talk about next week with respect to translations. That is, with the vocabulary, I tried to find all the rare words in the 316 verse. I tried to find where else that they were used in the Bible or other, you know, or by that author, especially by that author, if possible. Similarly, about the ideas treated in there, I would do that. Sometimes it would just be a quirk. Like, for example, I found out that Ruth 3:15 had a very interesting history because of a typographic error in the King James Bible. So I couldn't resist talking about that because I was into typography, you know. Okay, so it's definitely a bias. By the way, it turned out that just at the same time as I published this book, a movie came out called 3:15. And it turns out that this was a movie for teenagers. 3:15 is when school lets out, and this is what happened at that time. I did always try to, you know, sometimes I couldn't use a definite rule for this case because sometimes the story ends at the 16th verse and starts at the first verse. Sometimes the story begins at the 16th verse and goes on. So of course I would use that as a clue. I guess I went far afield also in Numbers 3:16 because there was something where I could use my mathematical skills, and that there's a bias there that somebody else would have done it a different way. It turned out there's some very very peculiar numerical properties to the numbers that are reported for the census that's taken in the book of Numbers, and it can be explained by understanding the linguistic basis for numbers, which would indicate that the data is actually more ancient than the person who was writing it down. And I couldn't resist that, so I got tempted by some real tidbits that were slightly off the methodology, but primarily I had a system. I think that you can judge for yourself, but I followed my own instincts as to what was interesting or not. But pretty much I wanted to get the context and really zoom in on all the things that are directly for this main verse. Yeah. Okay. Now, left wing.
Were you ever in your sample? Did you ever attempt a situation that different versions, different editions of the Bible, numbered different verses?
Yes. Yeah. The question is, some Bibles have different verse numberings than others. Yes. For example, in the Vulgate. The Psalms have a different numbering scheme. So Psalm, the Psalm I know as Psalm 23 is Psalm 24 in the Vulgate. There are several other cases besides where I could have used a different one. But my rule was I would use the one that was the most common in English Bibles, like the King James Bible and its predecessor. Because this was true actually in the vast majority of Bibles. They have at least this as an italicized number, if not a Roman number, for the ones that, because everyone has to know that one and some others. The later Bibles, the ones that new translations come out, they'll reorder some of the verses because there's good scholarly evidence that the text got mangled. Sometimes even parts of one chapter will move into another in the book of Job and so on. But still they retain the numbering scheme. They didn't renumber the verses. But there are a few differences. I think it only would have affected one or maybe two of the 3:16s, actually. Now I'm going to take the right hand. Yeah. Yes, please. Okay, so the 59 that I have are all from the main canonical books. By the way, I should say that the ones that are left out, I was it wasn't hard to see why it was reasonable to leave them out, because they were all similar to other books that were neighboring to them. So, Obadiah, Haggai, rather similar. Titus was very much like Timothy. Jude was very much like 2 Peter, and so on. But about the Apocrypha, the books like Judith and Tobit and Maccabees and so on, those I left out. I tried to keep, the project down to a reasonable size. But if I were to study the Apocrypha, that's what I would do first, is try the same method on them. Yes. I've got to go over here.
I have a question regarding whether you felt you got the major theme of the Bible by doing this. Just very quickly, there's a famous anecdote about a man who was depressed and randomly opened the Bible and found a verse and said, and Judas went out and hung himself.
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, in computer science studies, I've never been that much of a fan of worst case estimates. I've heard that joke too, I doubt if it's a true story, but because you have to work pretty hard in order to do that. But there are some very depressing verses if you take them that way. You could find other examples on the other side as well. But I have no way to know that without doing more and more tests like I did on these paths. I did a few thousand tests to get that one. Here I've done 59 tests. But I just had this feeling that the standard deviation was small enough that it was reasonable. But I don't know. That's what, as I say, overconfidence was the greatest flaw in this method. That it seems to work. You have to remind yourself that it might not be the whole thing. However, I would say that given the amount of hours I put into this, it beats any other method. That I would do it in that amount of time. It couldn't be satisfying to me for somebody else to give me a reading program and say read this and this. I would have to wonder if somebody else might not have given me a particular one, and just because the first person might have given me those three verses that you mentioned. Way back. Yes. So I think the Old Testament had 39 of the verses, and the New Testament had the other 20, or was it 38 and 21? It was something like that, I believe. I can't remember the details, but it was. So I have a lot more, about two thirds in the Old Testament. And in the New Testament, not only do you have the time frame, but you have the fact that Paul wrote a lot of epistles. So I got into one author a lot more that way, although the Deuteronomic history in the Old Testament also makes a fairly consistent pattern. I would say the sampling method allows you to see exactly how time influences things. It gives you a pretty good insight into this kind of similarities and differences. Back, second last row. Yes, it's you. Third last. What was... Right, the least interesting verse is, it was hard to say. People have said you're bound to run into a genealogy. And it's true, First Chronicles 3:16 was a genealogy, but it turned out to be a really interesting genealogy. I came to the conclusion that if I were a pastor of a church, I could speak on any one of these 59 on a Sunday morning and give a sermon that would not be a dud. And I said this to a pastor at University Lutheran at Stanford, and he took me up on it. And along came, you know, the reading for the day was Micah 3:16, and so he invited me to preach the sermon that day. And well, I got even with him. I mean, you know how professors always talk for 50 minutes. So I gave a sermon, and before I realized how long I was going on, it had lasted 50 minutes. So he didn't ask me anymore. But anyway, I don't think I wasted any of those 50 minutes either. I 5-0. I would say that I had to stretch the most on Numbers 3:16, which was simply the text is it's almost nothing. Moses enumerated the sons of Levi as he had been commanded by God. Now, I looked at a lot of there, but to find out what, you know, I had to go and figure out what the enumeration was all about. So that's where I think I had to push a little bit. But in almost every case, I had to cut. I have a very tight format in this book. With each book, I have a page that is an introduction to the book. It sort of gives the whole, you have to understand something about the author and the context, what period of time it's coming from. So this tells about, sort of summarizes the book, in this case, of Zechariah. Then I have calligraphy of the Zechariah 3:16. Then I have two pages that summarize everything I was able to find in the libraries about Zechariah 3:16, which actually turns out to be Zechariah 4:6. But also there's a certain number, fixed number of lines on this page. I had to use tech to typeset it and make sure there are no widow lines and so on. But I had to cut to get down to this number of lines. And so I have a lot of discretionary paragraphs in there that in the manuscript that says, leave this out if you don't have space. And I had to leave out a lot. So I didn't find that much. To my surprise, I didn't find that much deadwood, where there wasn't much to talk about. And I would say Numbers 3:16 had to be the one that where I had to go out into the context before I got a story. Michael?
Yes. There are places, many instances where this would apply. For example, I would suspect that if you took a tax code of some country, say the U.S. tax code, which is completely unmanageable, and you would sample it this way, I think you could probably get a pretty good idea of, the direction and the purpose and so on of the particular tax code. But could you apply, do you see an application in other areas? For example, could you take genes? So DNA sequences which code for the phenomenon, and do some kind of sampling of the stretch. And then, for example, distinguish between a gene for the or a set of genes for plant life systems and animals.
Yeah, were people able to understand this? Michael Raven says so. Consider first of all applying this method to the U.S. tax code. He figures that even in spite of the fact that it's pretty dull, you'd be able to get the idea of the U.S. tax code by random sampling. Then he said, now, what if you tried to apply this to genes, to biology problem DNA? There's a complex thing, and there's lots of There's lots of code that doesn't get expressed in proteins that people are wondering what is it there for. Is it, and could you tell by random sampling maybe whether or not plants are a lot different in this respect than animals and so on? You know, I have a hunch that when don't take me seriously, but I have a hunch that when this unknown parts of the DNA are decoded, it's going to turn out to be copyright notices. The patent protection.
To
the parts that are expressed and not the parts in between that aren't done. Yeah, that really ought to be done. I mean, I think somebody would work on a few of these and try to do exhaustive understanding of a few things taken at random instead of trying to solve the whole problem. Of course, people do that in some sense. They look very much at a gene that seems to be correlated with multiple sclerosis or something. But this random method would give you more of an idea about the whole process of genes, not a specific one. Yeah, very good points. It's hard for me to choose unbiased. Say, Anna, can you choose me? Can you choose a question? Yeah. Yeah, no, I think it would work in the sky. I really think that you get a balanced understanding of something if you look at the random parts of it. This has worked so well in so many other things. I can't see that. I mean, you take problems in computational geometry and they study a little bit of it and they can figure out properties of constructions that weren't done by human beings. They're purely mathematical type things or things that arose in ways that don't seem to relate to intelligence particularly. So I would say no matter what complicated thing you have, there's a fairly good chance that random sampling, I don't know. If you start out with purely random data, then random sampling is going to tell you that it was purely random data. I mean, Anna, you get to choose one.
I just was curious whether you felt that your qualitative analysis would have been better if you'd chosen a purely random sampling method as opposed to the sort of human heuristic that you ended up choosing for ease of determination in your course.
Right. Do I think I would have a better sample if I'd used a purely random thing? For example, I could have... I don't think it was a bad idea to get only one verse out of a long book that had one author, but I thought it was bad to get only one verse out of the Psalms that had many authors, because there's something about the even though Book of Ecclesiastes is very short, I think it's a very important part of the Bible. So I wouldn't want it to be underrepresented by a method that just takes every verse equally. I would definitely want to have something that has some kind of stratification by authors or something like that. But given that, I think I could probably have gotten slightly better qualitative things if I had a random thing. But nobody would have known if I had done it fairly. I didn't start out writing this book with the idea that anybody was going to check whether I'm being fair or not. I started out just because with this class and we found it worked, and so then we made it into a book. But in fact, after the fact, it is more interesting that you got the qualitative method by something that was fairly clearly not rigged. In the fifth lecture, however, I'm going to admit that there probably was some rigging. In that lecture, when I'm giving the conclusions, I'm also going to mention that it's possible that the reason I chose the 3:16 rule in the first place was that I had, you know, that I had heard somebody say, "Oh, Galatians 3:16," you know, and I would say, "Interesting," you know, in the back of my mind, this might have been there, suggesting that I would choose this rule for other verses than John. It's not an impossible thing, and I'm going to address that question in the fifth lecture.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Dr. Dobbs, check.